Welcome to the E-Commerce Lab by eComsy. This is the place for everything related to Amazon private label and e-commerce. Learn exactly what you need to start or scale your business. Get insights from the top industry experts who will discuss the latest trends and best practices in the world of Amazon. From choosing products and sourcing from a supplier to setting up your Amazon account and marketing your business, you will hear it here. Let's get started. Here is your host, Vincenzo Toscano.
Hello, guys. Welcome to another episode of the E-Commerce Lab by eComsy, the place of everything related to Amazon FBA private label and e-commerce. My name is Vincenzo Toscano, your host, founder and CEO of eComsy. And today I bring you another special guest. His name is Matt from 8X, which is a company that specializes on everything to do with understanding your e-commerce business and help you manage the cash flow around that. Cash flow is king. If you don't have a cash flow, business dies. And that's what I want to talk today. Like, I really want to deal down into the details. What are some of the tips? What are some of the mistakes also, you know, founders do within the e-commerce business that don't allow them to manage the cash flow effectively? So, Matt, it's a pleasure to have you here on the show. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here, man. I'm super excited to, you know, learn more about, you know, how effectively, you know, manage the cash flow of a business, because I feel people worry too much about having the right product, having the right advertisement strategy, having the right marketplace. But then all that comes down to pieces if you don't have the cash flow to sustain the growth. So before we dive into that, though, I would like to, you know, learn more about you and what your company does. I'm sure people will be intrigued to, yeah, learn from the journey. Yeah,
sure. Yeah. I mean, I was a CFO for, you know, 5 years for a private equity group. So we did a lot of investing. We did private lending. And so that's really where I got into the world of cash flow. So I got to do cash flow for our company, but also looking at cash flow and finances for the people we invested in. So a lot of exposure to what other companies are doing, what we could do. And that really formed the basis of what I do now. And then near the end of my time there, I had a friend that just said, hey, could you help me with cash flow for my business? I went and I helped him and his wife with their brand, and we helped him a lot. And it was so much fun because, you know, I wasn't just making money for this investor group, but I was making money for a friend of mine and who owned a small business that we wanted to succeed. So after that first kind of project with my friend is when I was like, okay, I'm going to do this as a job. Mm-hmm. So it took a couple of years after that, but then I started full time in 2021. And now we're supporting, I think, 30 e-com businesses around the world and, you know, helping people make more money, have more cash, have less stress is the whole plan.
That's so cool, man. And tell me a little bit about why is focus on cash flow. Like, what made you so interested around cash flow? I'm sure it was due to you figuring out throughout your journey, like, cash flow is king. But what made you, like, really diving into, you know what, I really want to help e-commerce founders to figure out the cash flow? Yeah.
So I had this experience where I was working with one of these in the private equity group. We had a business that I was working with, and the way this business worked was they had quite a bit of revenue, they had quite a bit of profit, and it was a construction development company. And the way that the payment terms were meant that we could make a lot of profit, but we were going to run out of money before we collected the payments. And so what I noticed was about 18 months from when I figured this out is when we would go bankrupt because we didn't have enough money. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of highlighted that to the folks in the team there. And we made a plan to change it. And in about 9 months, we basically figured out a way to restructure how we're doing things such that we had enough cash. And and that business is still around today, doing well.
Nice.
So Good. That was probably
pivoting moment.
it was pivotal, because I saw how much profit we're making, and it was the payment terms that killed us, that would have killed us anyway.
Mm-hmm. Good. So now, being said that, and the experience, of course, you have gone through in terms of your own, you know, journey, and at the same time now the e-commerce businesses that you manage. I guess one of the first questions I would like to ask you is, like, what are some of the big mistakes sellers and founders are doing with the e-commerce business? Because I'm sure a lot of people listening and watching this episode right now, like, doing things that is in a negative way affecting their cash flow. And sometimes can be small things that they don't even realize that in the long term can be a huge drawback in terms of, you know, the growth of their business. So what are some of those elements you will say you usually identify that people are doing wrong when it comes to cash flow?
Yeah. So one that is maybe counterintuitive that I see pretty often is when someone is having success selling sort of their main thing. Let's say it's, I don't know, like water bottles or whatever, right? So they're selling this main thing. It's going quite well. And they're like, okay, well, now we want to increase our LTV and our repurchase rates and our AOV. So we're going to add new SKUs that are not in the same, necessarily the same thing. And then they invest in the product development and they buy the new SKUs and they turn quite slowly and they still try to sell them. But what happens is, imagine you're taking a bag of cash and you're putting it on a shelf and now you can't touch that cash because it's stuck there and you have to wait to sell it. And so slow moving SKUs is one of the biggest things that I see lately where people could unlock cash a lot faster. And again, I mean, I think it's okay to do one thing really, really well. And then you don't have to try to do a bunch of other things. And financially speaking, what I'm saying is, yeah, people are just leaving bags of cash on the shelf because they're trying to bump LTV, but it's not really working, not materially. That's a big one right now.
I see that a lot as well with brands that we manage. Like, and I think that's I think for most founders, they assume that's the natural path they have to take as a business because they think, okay, I have a bestseller now. I wanna develop more bestsellers, but the reality is you're not always gonna have a new product that's gonna become bestsellers, right? So I guess being said that, like, is there some maybe strategy people can do where they still could launch products, but they can avoid that you know, that situation where, as you say, tie the money down? Maybe what I'm trying to say with this is, like, is there certain timelines maybe people have to consider before doing this jump? Like, do they have to really make sure that the main product is very stable before doing the jump? Or what is the dynamic? Because I'm sure some people still want to do it, but I guess there are certain steps that you have seen in business, like, that's the proper way of really diversifying, right?
So I have two examples that I'll draw on. And one is where they tried it effectively and still didn't work. And one is where they tried it effectively and it did work. And they're both good examples, and I'll explain why. So one of my clients had an outstanding product and lots of organic reach and so on and so forth. And what they did was they made the next level of complication. So it's like double the price of the old product. But before they did that, they paid a software called Luz, L-U-Z-Z. And they were doing competitor research and colors, and they could get all this data on what their competitors were selling and launching. And so they spent a lot of time and a lot of money on data. When they launched the new product, it was the biggest launch they've ever done. They did probably $500,000 in the first week or something like that. And they couldn't keep it in stock. And they kept selling out and they went on pre-sale and people would buy up to pre-sale and it was nuts. So they've done two launches since I've been with them and they've both been resounding successes, but they spent a lot of time understanding what are competitors doing? What are the price points? What's organically people are saying? What are even the colors that are selling the best on a competitor's website? So a lot of research. So research, I think, and understanding your consumer works well. Now, the second example is where I have a client that has launched a few products that didn't land. But what they did was they did research, they tried to do a product, but they only made limited runs of it. So they didn't make a whole bunch of it. Now, they've lost money on this, of course, as you would, but they've limited the bleeding because they only did limited runs. So they're not sitting on a whole bunch of inventory. Further than that, they were willing to cut the SKUs that weren't working instead of continuing to repurchase and just hoping. When they didn't follow the velocity pattern that they wanted to see on launch, they just cut them. Okay. And so both of those are good examples of what to do, because
yeah,
invariably you're going to fail some point when you try to launch something new. But if you limit your risk and you cut it quickly, you're not going to lose the money that I'm, like, you're not leaving bags of cash on the shelf.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I think the first example is a very good one, because I feel having as much data as possible, which means consumer insights, is something that's super valuable. Like, we do that all the time as well. Like, for example, when we launch new products on Amazon, like, we really want to make sure that we do tests with a sample that represents avatar, right, to see if they might like this new product, this new color. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very good advice. Now, another thing that people struggle a lot with when it comes to cash flow is where to allocate this cash flow, right? Mm. Because when you start growing and growing and growing, right, then sometimes you might fall into the trap of thinking like, okay, I can afford things that I couldn't afford before, and then you start making expenses that are not maybe the smartest decision. But the fact that you see the money coming in the bank, you have the perception that you can afford it, but then realistically you can't. So I guess how you assign those priorities on your business in terms of, okay, this money has to go to new product development, this money has to go towards advertisement, this money has to be toward dividends. Like, how you assign that distribution of cash flow, especially when the business is growing, because I guess it's difficult, especially if, you know, the business is growing, to really assign the percentages across different areas, right?
Yeah. So there's you're talking about percentages. Well, there's a book called Profit First, right, by Mike Michalowicz, and it's good for a few kinds of people. One is where the business is quite small. The other is where the business owner doesn't have any financial support, and the other is where they just want something really simple. So you just go to that book, grab it, follow the percentages, and you will be totally fine if you do it that way. What will happen, though, is you won't be able to grow as fast. And that's okay if you need the simplicity and the comfort, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. If you want to try to grow your business and, you know, whatever, get somewhere meaningful, you probably can't use Profit First, at least not for very long. The way that you think about growth is this. In the first case, limit your fixed expenses. Keep as small as possible, as long as possible. Meaning, don't get an office, don't hire people you don't need, don't sign leases for cars and whatever else, you know, anything fixed, right? Anything fixed. Keep them away as long as possible. And the reason why is for any dollar or pound of fixed expenses, generally for a Shopify seller, you need $4 to $5 or pounds to cover it. For an Amazon seller, that can be $5 to $6 to $7dollars or pounds to cover a $1 fixed expense. So if you sign a car lease for $1,000, you need to bring in an extra $5,000 revenue or $7. So just limit your fixed expenses. The next one is like marketing, you know, for Amazon or Shopify. Typically, you're now spending between 20 and 40% of revenue ads, right? And so it is a competitive advantage to be able to spend 40% and still be profitable. But what that means is you have very, very low fixed expenses. So keep those as low as you can. Now, here's when to ball out. If you have between 6 and 12 months of your expenses saved in a bank, then you can do a bit of the fun stuff, right? Or if you have 6 to 12 months of expenses and you can buy a car cash, fucking go ahead. Why not? Right. Mm-hmm. Unless you want to grow. Or could you sign a lease? That's a fixed expense. So still don't sign a lease, but you can afford to ball out when you have that buffer in reserve. And I would say before that, try not to so much, because it's just, you know, any business under sort of 10 million, even maybe 5 million. But anyway, it's not necessarily what I would call stable. And like, you just know the business will be there in 2 years, 3 years. You don't know it.
This can go sideways. Yeah.
It could go sideways. And then you're stuck with all this, you know, releases overhead. So a key premise that I learned from somebody else recently is to be able to scale down as fast as you scale up. So as you're growing, yeah, scale up, but make sure that if something happens, you can scale down quickly.
You have flexibility, essentially.
Yeah, and I have a client where we lost 10% of revenue for the year. So if a year's worth of revenue, let's say 10 million, our forecast was cut by 1 million with 2 months left in the year. And we're still going to be profitable because we can scale down as fast as we can scale up.
Okay. Very important. Now, I guess it's something that people would like to also get some advice on, especially those Amazon sellers that start to create a team around their business, right? They start to have an overhead, they start to have a PPC manager and all of that. Mm-hmm. Like what you say is very important. Like, of course, try to keep those expenses as low as possible. But sometimes I get this question all the time as well, like what percentage of revenue I could afford in terms of teams, in terms of wage, right? And based on your experience, I would be interesting to hear that, like, what percentage of revenue usually a company should be aiming to allocate towards having employees in terms of going towards salaries, for example.
If you're a brand selling a product, the ideal target is under 10%, and lower if you can. Now, again, this changes as you get much, much bigger, but I work with clients that are well above 50 million where it's under 10%. And it's a number where, again, you're keeping fixed costs low, which means you can advertise more than your competitors. And that's the trick, you know, because if you can only spend 20% of revenue on ads, someone else out there is figuring out how to spend 30, 40, and they're going to outbuy you, right? So 10%, under 10 is a great, is an advantage. I work with somebody in the EU last year. They're spending 7 or 8 on like 20 million euros a year. So just try to stay lean. That's hard going for the owner, because it means the owners have to work very, very hard. Yes.
That's the thing. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, but this is where if you have cash reserves, you have a bit more freedom. So this company that I'm talking about, 20 million euros, they were growing so, so, so fast that they didn't have cash reserves because they had to keep buying inventory. But the owners were okay to work that hard. Now, if you as an owner don't want to work that hard.
Do you want to be in the beach?
You want to be in the beach, grow just a little bit slower. Have cash reserves and then hire the ops manager. Who cares?
Yeah.
Right. It's all about kind of finding what you want and then balancing the needs. But again, if you have reserves, do whatever you want. Right. If you have 12 months of OPEX in cash, do whatever you want. Right. Because you can make any scale up, scale backs within 12 months. If you have 3 months of operating expenses, you have to be more careful, because when you fire somebody, sometimes you have to pay them a month of severance or whatever. So then you can't pivot so quickly. It's all about balance. If you want to be on the beach, just grow slower and you'll be fine. And if you want to grow super fast and then exit, just work harder and you'll also be fine, right?
Of course. Now, in terms of the cash flow game, I think it also creates a big impact when you're trying to also optimize toward an exit, right? Because whatever you do in the books, of course, it's going to be reflected in the valuation of your business, right? Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about that, because, of course, you know, we always hear this advice from business owners. Oh, yes, try to put as many expenses as you can to the business and reduce the profitability and all of that. Yeah. But at the same time, that's a very bad advice if you're looking to exit, because that reduces your numbers and the multiples, you know. So let's talk a little bit about that, like how a person that's preparing to exit should change their view towards cash flow.
So very good that you highlighted that, because it's really prevalent advice, and it's really terrible advice. And there's two reasons why. One is the exit side, but the other is, if you don't post a profit, you can't get any loans, especially today. You used to be able to 2 years ago, 3 years ago, but now you can't get investment and you can't get loans if you have no money. Now, on the selling side, if you can convince your buyer that this was discretionary spending that they will not have to spend, sometimes it's okay, but they have to believe you. If they don't believe you, it doesn't matter. So you're right. You should be careful. When you're getting towards an exit, there's a few things that are important, and that is the velocity of your growth and the profitability, and then also how well does the team run without you there. There's a three quite big things. If you're small, don't worry about the team thing. You can't do much about that until you're above 10 million. That you everyone, any buyer knows that you're needed. If you're above 10 million, try to work on getting your team to a place that you could be off for a month and they'd run just fine without you.
And the you'll business get a better, doesn't die.
Yeah, you'll get a better valuation, right? Also, if you can be growing as a brand above 30%, 40% a year, that increases your valuation. Then if you stack on above 10%, 15% sellers' discretionary earnings or net income or EBITDA, that further adds to the valuation. Meaning that not only are you getting more dollars because of 15% EBITDA, but you're getting a higher multiple. So let's say your business is doing 10 million a year and you're making 1 million profit. Okay. Someone will probably pay you, let's say,
3 to 5x, maybe?
3 to 5x. So let's say 5 million. Okay. Great. But if you're growing at 40% a year, they might pay you 6. And if your EBITDA is 2 million, they might pay you 7 or 8. So you see that these things are multiplicative, not just, you're not just adding things, it's they're multiplying. So velocity plus profit plus team that runs itself is like you push from 3 to 5 to 6 to 7, right? So there's all really important things.
Interesting. So now, interesting question that just came to my mind. Let's say you're going to our exit and we're talking about these two scenarios where you are as efficient as possible. You work like 16 hours per day. You don't have overhead and your profit is very high. Or you use part of the cash flow and you have a very stable team and the company doesn't need you, but the profit is much less. Which one do you think investor is more attractive?
Like, good question.
You see what I mean? Like super high profit, but you are like the 16-hour guy that does everything, or you have a stable team, you can really detach from the business, but profit is like half of what it is because you have to have an overhead to make that happen, right?
Good question, man. the terrible answer I have to give you is it depends, but I'll give you a few scenarios. Like, I'm not a broker, so I'm not as in touch with this stuff as a broker would be, but I will say that, if you're selling to somebody who is a strategic buyer, meaning they already do what you're doing, in either case, it shouldn't matter because you're working 16 hours a day, but they will already have people that are doing the work anyway. Yeah. So they won't need to worry about it. And if you have a team that is running the business, again, they'll remove some of your team. So it shouldn't matter for strategic. Now, and it's all negotiation now, but now if you look,
maybe
you
with a private investor, I guess that
yeah. Needs, so private investor
have a clue about the business. Yeah,
this is the thing. If it's a private investor that has no clue, and you're working 16 hours a day, that will hurt your valuation more so, I think, than the other way around. Because at 16 hours a day, you're doing so much of the work; it's a very huge concentration risk in one person. Whereas
what if you get sick or you cannot work anymore or whatever? Like all the business is on you.
That's the thing, right? And what they're likely to do is give you an earnout instead of all cash. Whereas if you had a team in place, they might give you more cash up front. And again, people aren't stupid. Well, unless they are, but people generally aren't stupid when they're buying businesses. They can see you're working that much and they'll know they have to hire for it. And they know that those hires will take time to understand the business. So I mean, again, talk to your brokers. They'll know even more than I do about this. But I suspect that building a business with a reasonable amount of profit with a team is better than working 16 hours a day and having extra profit.
Good. Now, to start concluding, in terms of some habits around cash flow and even tools, like is there some habits you would recommend that some founders can start from today to really put the cash flow on point? And maybe software that you recommend for this? Like, is there some advice around those two?
There's two softwares that I've seen before called Fathom and Dry Run. If you're a founder who is comfortable playing with the numbers, and if you don't want to use Excel, you can use either of these two softwares. They do not sponsor me. I've seen a founder use it really, really well and really effectively, and they didn't need a CFO because they were so happy to do this work in Fathom, I think it was. You don't even need a software. If depending, you know, one of the things that I would do is a habit I would build is having your profit and loss from Xero or QuickBooks or NetSuite, and then grabbing your last 6 months of P&L information, and then typing in the next 6 months. Just type in what you think it's going to be, a very simple forecast method, right? Type it in. What is it going to look like? And then when you're making decisions, I want to hire this person, I want to do this, type that in and see what happens to your profit. And the reason I say that is because something happens when you show somebody, oh, you were going to make $1 million this year. Now you're going to make 900 with that hire. It really does make them think. And so that's a really great habit. And also, I mean, if you're of a decent size, you can look for fractional CFO like me, but there's others like me that are out there. And again, it's not terribly expensive. But it can be quite impactful. I just that habit of staying lean as long as you can. Yeah. Yeah.
Super important. Good. That's very, yeah. I think those software actually never heard of them. So I'm going to check them out. It sounds very interesting. Cool. I appreciate so much, you know, all your tips, all the advice. I would say to conclude, is there anything else you feel like from cash flow perspective, maybe? After you know spending so much time with so many brands and yourself within the business model, that we should be aware of besides all the things you already mentioned, the dynamics. Is there anything else you think we should add to add the last gold nugget, as I call it, to the
e-commerce? One thing we didn't say is to negotiate with your suppliers. Build a strong relationship with your suppliers and then negotiate with them, and do it little bits at a time. I have a good friend, Kevin. He calls it nibbles. Take nibbles. So what I mean by that is, if you have a supplier in China, likely you're paying 50% to them for them to produce and 50% for them to ship. Your next question to them isn't, hey, can I have 30-day terms? They're not going to say yes. Your next question is, hey, can I pay 40% on deposit and 60% on shipment? Then it's, can I pay 30 and 70? Then you can say, hey, can I pay 30, then 50, then 20 when it arrives? And you're asking for small things each quarter. Ask for a new small thing. Hold up your end of the bargain and ask for new things. And then go visit. If you have a supplier in China, go visit them. Or in Southeast Asia, go visit them, because that relationship makes a difference, especially in those cultures, actually. So bring gifts. Go visit. Build a real relationship. And I have seen a client get 60-day terms with a supplier in Southeast Asia. This supplier is also keeping extra stock at no cost. And it's they visited them probably once every couple of years, and they know their kids and all these things. And it's a wonderful, wonderful relationship. And the value of that 60-day terms for this person is $1 million. So this year, they gave $1 million more in the bank because they have 60-day terms. But it took, you know, 5 years to build the relationship. So do that.
Awesome. That's a great advice to close the episode there. So thank you so much, Matt. And I'm sure, you know, some people might want to reach out to you. So you know, you can provide some extra advice and support when it comes to cash flow and exit. So how people can find you and get in touch with you.
So you can go to our website, www.8x.co, EIGHTX.co, and then LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn, Matt Putra. You can find me on there, DM me, ask me any questions you want. I try to post every day. Those two places.
Thank you, Matt. So pleasure to have you. See you in the next one. Yeah. Been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Vincenzo. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The E-Commerce Lab by eComsy. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. While you are at it, we would appreciate it if you could leave an honest rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. That will make it easier for others to find out about the show and benefit from it. Want more? Visit our website at www.ecomsy.com, where you can get your first consultation for free. Or Find us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn at ecomc.